Welcome to episode 22. I'm Stuart McCullough. I'm the CEO of VHAA. Starting with this week's industrial roundup, and in particular with community health, we are still awaiting feedback from the ASU with a view to trying to conclude the negotiations for a new SACS agreement. With respect to health and allied employees, we've had two very constructive meetings with the HWU and are currently setting a schedule for further meetings and are hopeful of being able to expedite that process. However, with respect to allied health professionals and VAPA, we've had a number of discussions about how it is that we might continue to have discussions with no agreement reached as yet. In particular, the claim by VAPA to have individual agreements rather than a group agreement and the different logs of claim are proving to be somewhat problematic. We have proposed a series of protocols to them that would enable those discussions to occur on a without prejudice basis, and though they have undertaken to consider those further. Thank you to those community health members who alerted us to the fact that they'd received a log of claims with respect to the HSU number 4 branch, which covers psychologists and dietitians. We've had an initial meeting with them and we'll be consulting with members to formulate a response to that claim as well as a employer log of claim shortly. With respect to public health services, we are currently going through a process of developing a log of claims for biomedical engineers. We have submitted for a new dentists and agreement and dental therapists agreement a draft log of claims to DHHS. Otherwise, we are in the process of beginning to conduct those meetings, the working groups for the SDPP. In particular, we've had one meeting so far with respect to the Health and Allied Services Managers and Administrative Employees Agreement, with a further schedule for 2017 of monthly meetings. There have been meetings also with regards to the Nurses and Midwives Agreement, and again a schedule set for the balance of the year. With respect to allied health professionals, we had put forward a schedule, but we have needed to amend that schedule in order to take into account the availability of some of their key people. With respect to those discussions, in particular with Health and Allied and the SDPPWG, the particular priority that was identified concerned occupational health and safety, as well as reducing absenteeism. Those processes are ongoing and we will be reporting on them regularly through the VHAA app. That's it for this week's Industrial Roundup. Welcome to the weekly update, where we go in depth with a particular subject. Joining me for this week's discussion is Principal Workplace Relations Advisor and the current number one ticket holder for the Mornington Seagulls Junior Soccer Club, Tim Nagle. Welcome, Tim.
Thanks, Stuart. Good to be here.
Tim, would you be good enough to do the honours and reveal this week's subject? So for the benefit of those people who are listening to this broadcast rather than watching, would you be good enough to describe what it is you see and what it is you think that this week's subject is?
It's a golden gnome, and it's I'm not sure the connection.
Tim, that's a gallant concession. Obviously, this is a homage to Walt Disney's 1937 animated classic Snow White and the Seven Dwarves, and this is a reference to one of the lesser-known dwarves. So, if you remember, there was Doc, Grumpy, Sneezy, Sporty, Scary, and Tito here. And in terms of Tito and his friends, they all worked in the mining industry and were subject to fixed-term contracts. And so this week's subject is fixed-term contracts.
Of course.
Tim, just in terms of fixed-term contracts, we start, as always, with the industrial instruments and what they have to say about that particular subject. So if we begin with the Nurses and Midwives Agreement, what does that have to say about the use of fixed-term contracts?
Well, it says that fixed-term contracts can only be used for true fixed-term arrangements.
Now, just in terms of that as a principle, that's a principle that is not confined just to the nurses' agreement.
No, it's a common principle across the agreements.
The clause under the nurses and midwives agreement then goes on to give a number of specific examples, although it's worth noting that they're examples only and not exhaustive.
Yes.
What are those examples?
So they list the examples of true fixed term arrangements to include graduate nurse positions, parental leave replacements, long-term work cover replacements, long service leave replacement, special projects and postgraduate training.
Okay. I think it's worth noting the fact that replacement of other staff is a key component for a number of those examples. And I think that's worth bearing in mind as to what is a true or genuine fixed-term arrangement. I think one of the challenges with fixed-term arrangements is that sometimes they're regarded as having some advantage to the employer which may or may not be present, which is one of the things I'd like to talk about today. That clause that you've referred to under the nurses and midwives, however, is not the only reference to fixed-term contracts. In what other contexts do they come up?
Yeah, so the other clauses that mention fixed-term contracts are clause 12.6 of the nurses' agreement, which talks about fixed-term contracts are subject to the relocation provisions of the redundancy clause. So where you're undertaking a redundancy and trying to mitigate against that change, then fixed-term employees also receive the change of relocation allowance.
So just in terms of that, it's worth noting that that provision is not unique to the nurses and midwives agreement, that in effect that operates as an exception.
Yes.
Because fixed-term employees generally don't have entitlements associated with redundancy, but relocation is a consistent exception across all the agreements.
That's right.
What are the other instances where fixed-term contracts are referred to under that agreement?
So the next example is clause 106, which talks about the employment of Rousson nurses. And as we know, those Rousson nurses are the registered undergraduate students of nursing.
And other examples?
So another example is a letter of appointment. Whether someone is a fixed-term employee is something that is required to be in the letter of appointment.
So effectively that operates as a requirement to ensure that people are clearly informed about the fixed-term nature of their employment.
That's right. And with, like many of these sort of disputes, it's about getting it clear up front.
And some of the agreements, although not all, also have an express exception in terms of the notice of termination provisions of the agreements. Why is that?
Well, I think a fixed-term employment ends because the term finishes, not because the employee gives them notice of the termination ending. So they don't apply in those circumstances.
In effect, I think where there is a legitimate, bona fide, true fixed-term arrangement, you are, in effect, giving notice at the outset.
That's right.
As to when the employment is going to come to an end. So that's a summary of what's contained within the nurses' agreement, and I think it'll be worthwhile us going through the other agreements in a moment. But before we do that, what does the Fair Work Act have to say with regards to the use of fixed-term contracts?
Well, so it does have some things to say about fixed-term contracts, notably Section 123 talks about fixed-term contracts in the context of the Fair Work Act providing a minimum entitlement to severance in the event that a role becomes redundant. So again, it links back to those fixed-term employees not being subject to the redundancy provisions.
It goes back to that issue, I guess, that there is no need to pay severance when the nature of the engagement itself recognises that it's
right.
For a limited period of time only. Does that mean that fixed-term contracts are a useful means by which to not have to pay redundancy?
No, because it's always going to link back to them needing to be genuine fixed-term contracts.
One of the things I'm mindful of is that within that same section, Section 123, it talks about that provision may apply irrespective of the fact that there's a fixed-term arrangement if it is that it's being utilised to avoid those provisions.
Yeah, and we know that commissions and tribunals and courts will look beyond sometimes exactly what the contractual arrangements are to actually look at the nature of the relationship. And I think this is an example of that going into the legislation.
I think the wording of the Fair Work Act is important in that instance where it talks about if a substantial reason for the fixed-term arrangement is to avoid those provisions, then that exception won't apply.
That's right.
So it doesn't need to be the only reason, it just simply needs to be a substantial reason. I'm mindful that we're talking about the Fair Work Act and redundancy, but members will be aware that the provisions under their agreements refer back to state, government, industrial relations policy, and that's the instrument, in effect, that prescribes severance for people under our enterprise agreement. What does the state government IR policy have to say with regards to fixed term contracts?
It says a number of things. Firstly, it states that enterprise agreements should limit the use of fixed term contracts and casual labour, and this is part of the government's commitment to permanency of employment. It also talks about that employers will give preference to ongoing forms of employment over fixed terms and casual labour wherever possible. Finally, it talks about that whether as part of bargaining or otherwise, employers and unions should work together to identify methods to reduce casual and fixed term labour.
It's interesting that corresponds so closely with our enterprise agreements that do have those kinds of provisions within them. But just in terms of whether or not a fixed term employee is subject to redundancy provisions, there is a provision in the public sector IR policy that says they're not entitled, but then there's something of a qualified catch-all.
So the policy says that, and precisely it says, however, specific consideration may need to be given to individual cases involving long-term casual employees or employees who have been employed on successive fixed-term contracts. And then it goes on to say further advice should be sought if the casual or fixed-term nature of an employee's employment is unclear. So it sort of gives an out-of-jail sort of provision.
So if there is a circumstance where somebody has had successive contracts, then relying on that fact to say that they're not entitled to redundancy may not be appropriate, that all the circumstances should be considered, and that if symptoms persist, you should consult with your doctor.
Yeah, that's right.
What do the other enterprise agreements have to say with respect to the use of fixed-term contracts? Perhaps if we start with the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement.
So for the Health and Allied Services, Clause 11 states that the employer will give preference to an ongoing employment to casual or fixed-term employments.
So you prefer ongoing employment rather than casual or fixed-term. That's a clear echo of the public sector IR policy.
Yes.
What else does the Health and Allied Managers and Administrative Workers Agreement have to say?
So it also, in the same clause, talks about dental assistants employed either at DHSV or alternatively at Ballarat Health Service, and impose a limit of 12 months on those fixed-term contracts.
Now, that's a bit concerning in the sense that it's possible for someone to take up to 24 months of parental leave.
Yes.
And it's a fairly difficult fit under those circumstances. So I think that's a clause that we all need to keep an eye on with a view to determining whether it's still fit for purpose.
Yeah, because it creates difficulties for appointing that same person into the next 12 months in those circumstances.
Leaving dental assistance aside, the clauses in the Health and Allied part of the agreement about fixed-term employment are replicated in the managers and administrative workers part of the agreement as well.
Yeah, that's right.
Just in terms of the mental health agreement, what does that have to say with regards to the use of fixed-term contracts?
So it also contains the exception to the giving of notice and letter of appointment requirements. Clause 23.4, it says, a fixed-term employee is an employee who is employed for a specified period of time, which period is known at the commencement of the contract.
Just in terms of that subclause, and what I find interesting about the mental health agreement is it does not expressly say, as the other agreements do, that it must be a true or genuine fixed-term arrangement as such. Does that mean that there's a different rule with respect to the application of fixed-term contracts for mental health employees?
Now, I think it's saying the same thing, but just in a different way. So fixed-term arrangements would still need to be genuine fixed-term arrangements.
So whilst the words are slightly different in the mental health agreement, the effect is exactly the same as the other agreements.
That's right.
What about the Allied Health Professionals Agreement? There's a bit more history there.
Yes, so the health professionals have got a long history around fixed-term contracts.
And a long clause that is befitting of that history.
Yes. So the clause for health professionals, as you say, is a lot more complex and has its own history. The pre-modern award and the state award before that had a provision for fixed-term contracts and temporary employees. The old award clause placed a 12-month limit, like the dental assistants at DHSV and Ballarat Health Services.
It's worth noting in terms of the 12-month limit that existed under the pre-modern award that came out of the State Commission had persisted in some form up until the new agreement came into place. Something that was clearly no longer fit for purpose and didn't suit the circumstances had managed to survive all the iterations of bargaining up until the last year.
And it caused the same problems that we talked about before in terms of replacement employees.
At the time there was that provision in the pre-modern award, at least from 2004 onwards, there's also been a requirement that they be utilised for true fixed-term arrangements. So that notion of genuineness, authenticity, keeps on coming up again about the use of fixed-term contracts. That is, that they can only be utilised in circumstances that are appropriate.
That's right.
In terms of the new agreement, it has a much longer clause. It does move away from some of the restrictions that previously existed. But just in terms of summarising some of those, I should, before we get to that, I'll just make the point that the other part of the history for allied health professionals, there was actually a magistrate's court decision which tested the pre-modern award and the 2004 agreement. And in that matter, I think from memory, it involved an employee whose the funding for the role finished. They had worked more than 12 months, and that 12-month limitation saw them declared an ongoing employee. And from memory, it meant that they were deemed to have been short on the notice that they were owed. So these provisions have been tested from time to time, but it just goes to show the depth of feeling that's been associated for allied health professionals and the use of fixed-term contracts. So in terms of the new agreement itself and some of the features of it, and starting at the top, there's a requirement then that it's still that the provisions be, or the use of the contract be, genuine.
Yeah, so they still must be genuine arrangements, genuine fixed-term arrangements. And the term genuine is defined.
Now, that's a little unusual, that it goes to the point of actually not leaving it up to the parties, but giving a specific definition. How is it defined?
So it's defined as, refers to research projects, special projects, and it even provides an example, such as NHRMC-funded project or STAT project. Backfilling for secondment, for those on leave, and any other genuine fixed-term arrangement agreed to by the union.
So there is a little bit of a catch-all in the event that a circumstance arises that's not within the contemplation of the agreement, notwithstanding that there are lots of different examples that are given. The clause then goes on to make an interesting point that says that you don't have to use a fixed-term contract if those circumstances are fulfilled. It's more a case that a fixed-term contract is available under those circumstances. What else does the clause provide?
It also says that that it must state in the letter of offer that it is a fixed term and the reason.
So in terms of a point of difference, if we go back to, say, the nurses' agreement or the mental health, where you've got to specify in the letter of offer that it is a fixed-term arrangement, what's different there is that additional requirement to make sure that the reason for the fixed term is clearly articulated. And that's really about connecting the fixed-term contract back to the clause under the agreement. Just in terms of the duration, previously we had, a 1-year limit with the possibility of another year. That's changed under the new agreement.
Yeah, so the duration can be from 1 year to 2 years, unless otherwise agreed to by the union at its discretion as well. So we have got that up to 2 years now.
I think that's important, having regard for the fact that the rights to take longer parental leave have changed. Just interestingly, with regards to the use of discretion to go beyond 2 years, so my understanding is that there are some additional positions that will be funded within the sector, and I think it's likely that there will be the exercise of that discretion to have fixed-term contracts beyond the two-year mark, which I think is just interesting to say that the union will be genuinely considerate of the circumstances.
Well, and like all things, there are some circumstances that lend itself to genuine fixed-term arrangements beyond the 2 years.
Well, just in terms of that, if you get to the end of the 2 years, the agreement now also provides for further fixed terms under specified circumstances.
So if the role continues, for instance, you can continue to use a fixed-term contract if it's still genuine fixed-term contract and appropriate, and that it doesn't exceed 2 years and doesn't go beyond 5 years in total.
One of the things that we were mindful of is that there are circumstances where a person has a fixed-term contract to replace someone, say, on parental leave. That contract comes to an end and the person is able to pick up another contract to replace someone else. So the agreement now envisages that kind of circumstance. We don't want to discourage that kind of arrangement, but there is an absolute cap and there are some specific procedural requirements under those circumstances, including that articulation as to the reason for the fixed-term contract, advising the person that they're entitled to have the union assist them, and a notification to the union where it goes beyond those boundaries. And whilst those procedural requirements are not the same as other agreements. They're a means by which to ensure transparency and get beyond the barriers that had previously existed under that agreement. There's also, I think, a provision for the SDPPWG and allied health professionals to consider the use of fixed-term contracts and how those can be limited to circumstances that are appropriate.
Mm. I think there's some sensitivities in that realm that we need to work through.
So just in terms of advice for HR departments who are required to administer these fixed-term contracts from time to time, what advice would you give to an HR person who was asked to redo a fixed-term contract?
Well, I think the first point is to always question whether a fixed-term contract is the appropriate engagement mechanism. So it should be a trigger for further inquiry generally.
I think there is a phenomenon that HR people are sometimes subject to where they're asked to renew fixed-term contracts in circumstances that are unnecessary. Mm. And it is worth testing whether it's appropriate for the circumstances or not. Mm. First of all, by considering the facts of the circumstance and then by the enterprise agreement, but not taking for granted that a fixed-term contract is the appropriate mechanism.
Yes. The second piece of advice would be to ensure the letters of appointment are clear. And really that's about trying to avoid disputation at a later point. Considering the terms of the individual enterprise agreement would be another tip. Mm. Just as we've talked about today, there are some nuances between agreements.
And some significant differences in the case of the Allied Health Professionals Agreement.
That's right. And finally, don't allow fixed-term contracts on the basis of an assumed benefit that may not be there. So it's about that critical questioning of whether a fixed-term appointment is the appropriate appointment tool.
Just in terms of that, I think it's worth considering for a genuine fixed-term arrangement, one that is not terminable by notice without reason, that there has been a tendency historically for people to utilise those on the basis that they can bring the employment to an end if it is that the employee is not suitable. The great risk of that, of course, is that you may be required to pay out the balance of the contract. Mm. And the risk of that may be far greater than the risk of terminating within the qualifying period.
No, that's exactly right. Or they may deem to be permanent anyway, so you'll be open to both sort of challenges.
So I think it goes back to that issue, goes back to where we started, and that's a matter of considering whether or not it is a genuine fixed-term arrangement, not accepting any assumed benefits that may be put to you and testing whether those are the case and whether a fixed-term contract is the best tool by which to appoint someone.
Exactly.
Tim, thanks very much for your time today.
Thanks, Stuart.
And thanks, Tigo.